Hello and welcome to Auntie Monkey. I'm Andrew Robertson and this is the Ballooning Podcast. So we're really excited that we've brought Auntie Monkey back. So this is our second episode since the break that we had for about a year and a half. And we're also really excited that you're all getting really back into the podcast. We've had lots of feedback via Facebook and via email, just telling us how glad people are that the podcast has been resurrected, especially when everyone's stuck at home with nothing much to do. So we have a number of episodes planned, but we're also always looking out for people to give us recommendations of who we should be talking to. So please hit us up on our Facebook page and let us know who we should be talking to and if there's any other great stories you'd like to share with us. So on with today's episode. Today, I'm sharing with you a conversation I had with Kim McGee. So Kim is a second-generation balloonist and a pilot from Iowa in the US. And Kim has really achieved a lot in ballooning in a relatively short period of time since she got her license. So not only has Kim previously competed at the Women's World Championships and done a lot of competition ballooning in the US, Kim is also a current world record holder. In fact, she holds 6 world records for distance and altitude. Kim has also done some amazing stuff when it comes to training and safety. So with her husband, Adam, they set up the Balloon Training Academy, which is helping new pilots and people getting into the sport to acquire their licenses and have done a lot of work running safety seminars and really are helping promote ballooning to the community and trying to get people into the sport. So today's episode, we talk about all of those things that I just mentioned. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with Kim McGee. Welcome to Auntie Monkey, Kim. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So there's a lot of things that I was going to talk to you about today. And I think what would be probably a really good way to sort of set the scene is, firstly, if we can maybe sort of find out a little bit about you and how you maybe got into the ballooning world.
Yeah, I got into the ballooning kind of how a lot of people my age seem to. I'm a second generation pilot. So both my parents are actually commercial pilots. So I was definitely one of the lucky ones who I was born into it. They got their first balloon the year I was born and just kind of known it ever since.
Is it really being a lucky one, or were you like the other second generation balloonists that were dragged out of bed at 3 in the morning and have no other life?
Yeah, I mean, I will say I wasn't one of the ones who got their license right away at 16. It took me leaving for college when ballooning wasn't in my life all the time to be like, oh, yeah, all right, I kind of miss that and I like it and that's something I should do. But since then, yeah, I like it.
So during your college days and before that, were you interested in other activities, non-ballooning, non-parental type activities?
Yeah, I was pretty active in high school, doing a lot of sports. I played field hockey, and I was really active in the band, so like marching band, symphonic band, and orchestras, those kind of things. So among other, you know, various high school clubs and things like that.
But then obviously fate took over and you got dragged back into the ballooning world.
Yeah, you leave home and you realize maybe your parents know a thing or two about fun hobbies and cool things to do.
So how old were you when you got your license?
I was 19 when I got my license. Pretty much all of my flying was done, all of my training was done at events. My dad was really big into flying around, mainly the Midwest and events in the U.S. And so I did a lot of my training at competition events, actually. So the big Indianola Balloon Festival here in Iowa is where I did all of my training. It's kind of like a solid 10-day morning and night. You fly all the time. It's a good way to pack in a lot of training and solidify a lot of good habits in a small amount of time.
I'm always interested, being a second generation balloonist myself, just what actually brings people back into the sport, because I think everyone tends to do that and goes off and explores their own activities. But what was it really that sort of brought you back into ballooning from having a break from it, essentially?
Yeah, it was, I just realized how much I miss being in the air. I mean, it's one thing, you know, I loved crewing. I loved being out with balloons. Sometimes it was a bit of a struggle to get up in the morning. But as long as you promised me that nap afterwards, you know, things are good. But then when I realized, you know, I could do this myself and I could, you know, fly on my own. And I thought it'd be kind of cool. I mean, it was terrifying at first, you know, a lot of jitters those first couple of years, and then kind of settled into a love for it and an eagerness to always be out there and up in the sky.
And you mentioned that you did a lot of your training in competition. Was that something that you thought that you would get into at that time? Or was it more just about, you know, going for a jolly and enjoying the flying?
Yeah, it was just going for a flight. We were flying a big fat 90,000 cubic foot round balloon with all these racers. So we were taking these weird approaches into targets where everybody else was kind of taking a straight line. We'd have to do the low and slow approach. And it was more about, along with the like solidifying, because we don't have a lot of nice days in the Midwest that are back to back to back. So we get a good chunk in late July and early August. And so we took advantage of that. And then doing the competition helps you, I mean, just helps navigate a balloon. So it helped get that feel for a balloon, you know, that, oh, I can control this and it's not something you need to be afraid of. And I don't have to worry about where I'm going to land, because if I see something out there, you know, I can go get it.
So you've done a number of competitions, both nationally and internationally now, including the Women's Worlds. What does that sort of journey look like for you in terms of, A, getting to the Women's Worlds, but also in terms of the types of competitions that you used to fly?
Women's Worlds is, on the international level, especially in Europe, they fly very differently in competition compared to what we do in the U.S. When I started flying, we never used loggers. I mean, it's all just markers on the ground. You'll have a couple tasks, mainly JDGs. I mean, there's no PDGs, there's no CRATs, there's no, you know, time task. It's all
throwing baggies at the X's. Yeah.
maybe a max distance double drop. If you're lucky, you might have one of those in a week long event kind of thing. So going from that sort of environment to the world, that first year I was there is just a huge eye opener. You know, I tried to practice as much as I could. I downloaded Aussie. I flew with it on my own here, just flying around my local area. But, you know, it's a whole different ballgame. And that's flying over there in Women's Worlds was where I really learned to appreciate, you know, that kind of flying, flying with the computers and flying with loggers, and kind of changes your thinking on how the flight planning should go.
Now, the other main area I wanted to talk to you a little bit about is in the last couple of years, you've taken on the world of breaking records. And I guess before we dive into the records themselves, where did that sort of passion or idea come from that you wanted to go and break some world records?
It was kind of a weird story how I got into it. I was actually just at this really small town event. And I think there was maybe 20 balloons there. And I just happened to get talking with one of the other female pilots. And she mentioned a number of years ago, she set a national record in a little hopper. And I was kind of a fairly new pilot at that point. I think I had my license for less than 5 years. And so I was thinking about it. I was like, well, my family has a hopper. It was a 35,000 cubic foot hopper. And being a smaller stature is kind of a benefit for world records. And so I thought, you know, this is something I could potentially do. So I looked into it, and I did actually fly a flight in my family's hopper, going for an AX5 distance record. But it's a standard weight fabric balloon. I mean, it didn't have anything special, and it was in the lower end of the category for the AX5. The AX5 goes up to 42,000 cubic feet. So I kind of, when I did that flight, I came up 17 miles short of getting the Women's World record. And so I learned a lot from that. But yeah, getting into doing the record flights themselves was just kind of I have this equipment. I'm a pretty good stature for it, as, you know, body type. And I thought it would be a good way to push myself as a pilot and learn a lot of new skills.
So before we talk about the flights themselves, maybe if you could kind of explain, because if you ever look at the FAI site, look at world records, it can get quite complex what the actual records are, because from what I understand, you've done 2 record flights.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? And then those 2 record flights have equated to 6 world records?
Yes, that's correct.
So what are the records that you actually hold, if you can remember them all?
Oh, goodness. I always have to look them up. I'm so bad. Yeah, so the way records work, it's easier to fly a bigger balloon further, longer, and higher, essentially. So what they do is they say if you fly a smaller category balloon, in my case, further than a bigger, the next size up, you also get that record. So that's how I ended up getting 3 records per flight, because I got the records for the size categories above me. So I have the AX5, I have the distance records, but the general and the female, so those count as 2 records in the AX5, and then I also got the female distance record in the AX6. And then on my other flight, I flew an AX2, which is a 14,000 cubic foot balloon, and I obtained the female altitude record for the AX2 and then the female distance record for the AX2 and AX3.
And was that the list that you were actually trying to break at the time?
and that balloon, no. Actually, I was going for the overall altitude record in the AX2, and there was a cloud deck that formed over me, and so I couldn't go as high as I wanted to, and it ended up being about 20 knots faster than I expected it to be up at altitude. So I just thought, well, while I'm up here and while I have fuel, we're going to get some distance up.
Just start ticking records off as you go. So maybe let's look at the 2 flights. So the first flight you did, that was the, which one was that?
Yeah, so the first flight I did last year was for the AX2, that was for the little balloon.
Right. And I've seen photos of that. The balloon that you're flying looked fairly specialized for that sort of flight. Is that right?
It was, yeah. So we kind of stumbled upon this balloon because, as I mentioned before, I did this failed attempt the previous year in my family's standard hopper. And so we were looking for a bigger, lighter weight AX5 balloon. And we found one, and the guy who was selling that also had this AX2 that I had built specifically for record flights. So it's made out of Trisby, which is in the family of Mylar. So those kind of silvery, crinkly balloons you get at birthday parties, that's a Mylar balloon. But so this is very crinkly. It's super lightweight, but it's actually see-through. But one of the nice things about it is it can hold temperatures that are almost twice what a normal balloon fabric should be able to sustain. So that helped me bring up more fuel, which helped me get up to altitude and stay up there a while.
And that sort of fabric, I mean, when you first, did you do any test flights before you actually went for the flight itself?
No. I wish I, it's something I'm glad I didn't think about until I was up there. This was actually only my second flight ever in a hopper configuration, because when I flew the other balloon, it was, we had this collapsible basket that we put under it. But this one I flew as a hopper, and the last time I had flown a hopper balloon the hopper bottom end with your feet dangling was over 5 years prior to that. And so it was, it's something I didn't do a test flight. This balloon is not made to do a lot of flights. It might have one more flight in it. At least I'm hoping it does. But it wasn't made to do a bunch of flights or a bunch of fun flights. So we did all of the calculations and made sure there were so many spreadsheets that I did after day after day, multiple times a day, to make sure, we had this all loaded correctly and what we could do with it. But yeah, we didn't do that. There was no test flight done of it. I did fit myself in the chair. We winched it up at my dad's shop and fit myself in it. So I knew I would be able to reach everything. Cause I'm a little short, so I have troubles reaching burners, normal balloon. So I actually did have to make a little foam pad for me to sit on because we had it, the seat, buckled up as high as it could go. And I was still a little short for me. So we did make some modifications to be able to beforehand that so we would know it would work, but not in the actual flight.
So you're sitting at over 10,000 feet in a balloon you've never flown, made out of basically clear plastic bags in a hopper seat.
At what point
did you realize, wonder you what you're doing?
Yeah. As my husband Adam likes to say, I'm crazy. I'm just trying not to think about it.
Oh, if you're going to be crazy, you may as well do it in style.
Right. Everybody's got to be crazy about something. So.
And we'll put some of the photos up on the webpage, but looking at the day they did that flight, it looked fairly cold, especially for someone coming from Australia.
Yeah.
What sort of temperatures were you dealing with in that flight?
Yeah. So up at altitude, we were... somewhere below, I'm going to have to do the Celsius conversion.
You can talk Fahrenheit.
In Fahrenheit, it was started off at negative 17 Fahrenheit on the surface. And when I got up to altitude, it was somewhere around negative 40 Fahrenheit, which is also negative 40 Celsius, to negative 50 Fahrenheit. So it was
ridiculous.
Yeah.
And how long did the actual flight go for?
Almost 2 hours.
Right. So you had enough time to really get cold.
Yes. Yeah. Plenty of time to get nice and freezing.
So what was the, if you can remember, what were the actual altitudes and distances you did for that flight?
So the altitude I went to was, and the official altitude is in meters. So it's 3,149 meters. And I went 98.4 kilometers.
And do you remember how much you had to beat to get those records?
Yeah. So the previous record in kilometers was 22.68 kilometers.
So you quadrupled that.
Yeah. Yeah. That one kind of blew out of the water. And then the altitude record was 2,293 meters.
Right. So both of them, you've put a serious gap between yourself and the previous record.
Yeah.
And during that flight, were there any sort of interesting things that happened?
Yeah, I wish I could say that record flights, you know, all the planning you put into them, everything goes perfectly. But I mean, everybody knows that's not the case. there's a lot of little things. At that altitude, there's oxygen deprivation, and this was a smaller burner. So it wasn't as equipped to handle that oxygen deprivation as what a normal burner would be. And so there was a lot of flameouts, and I like to say there were a lot less than what I had done on my first failed attempt of the X5 flight, because I think I only had 10 to 20 flameouts. So I still lived with the Striker in my hand, and I was constantly relighting the burner. It didn't seem to matter if I cranked it on slow or let it off slow or fast or whatever. It just decided to go out on its own. And that's pretty terrifying when you're up there at 10,000 feet. And it's so cold out. So in a heartbeat, you're dropping like a rock. You're already going down almost 1,000 feet a minute and, trying to get this relit and knowing, you know, the faster you're going down, the harder it is to get this relit. And there's not much you can do about it.
Especially when you're sticking your arm above your head with a Striker.
Yeah, you can't see what you're doing. Yeah. So I got really good at being able to fly Striker after a while and getting that relit. Every time you have a flame out, you're also wasting fuel. So you're also hurting, you know, your ultimate goal, because, you know, fuel waste is, you know, the most critical thing in record flights. You want to have as much fuel as possible. So
being a hopper, how much fuel did you actually carry? I assume it's more than the normal just single tank on your back.
No, I did. I carried a single tank, but it was a 20-gallon tank. So it was large. And because it was so cold, I could carry that much fuel. That's why I waited for it to be
ridiculous.
Absolutely. Yeah. The word polar vortex was thrown around and I'm like packing my gear ready to drive up to North Dakota so I could get even colder weather. And yeah, so that's why we picked those days. But yeah, it was just a single tank. We had looked into possibly doing two titanium tanks for lighter weight, too, with those 13.5-gallon titanium tanks. I mean, my whole thing with these records was just safety. I wasn't willing to break a bone on these records. I wasn't willing to lose my life. I wasn't willing to compromise anything that I wouldn't do in a regular flight, or, you know, I wouldn't allow for in a regular flight.
Sure.
I went with the regular stainless steel bottom end, hopper bottom end. It was a Lindstrand hopper bottom end and a stainless steel 20-gallon tank, just because if I had to land and drag out somewhere, I wanted to make sure I was protected.
So you mentioned you flew for 2 hours, which is a long hopper flight. How much fuel did you actually end up at the end with?
Yeah, I actually didn't use, I still had, it was like 6.8 gallons left, something around that mark. I had so much left because it was so cold. I had done all these projections. Granted, I was projecting I would go up to 15,000 feet. And I thought I would be up, down in about an hour's time. And so I'm creeping over the hour 15 minute mark and I'm looking at the mirror above me to see the fuel quantity gauge, and it's still pegged and it's not coming off the peg. I thought for sure I'd be showing on fuel by now. I thought, you know, I'd had to have used most of my fuel. And so I was convinced that my fuel gauge had just frozen and it just wasn't going to register. And so I started actually descending. And by the time I got down to 5,000 feet, then of course the fuel gauge decided to come off the peg and show I still had 35% fuel left. So.
And at that point you decided you're still going, just going down.
I did think about it, but at 5,000 feet, the winds were maybe 15 knots. I mean, it wasn't worth staying up any longer. And, it was just, I had been up for 2 hours. I got the records I knew I was going to get. I could have stayed up. It would have been nice to stay up another, 20 kilometers or so. There was an AX4 record I gotten for distance, but you know, I wasn't going for distance at all. So it wasn't in my mind. As I was coming in, I saw my crew there and I was like, well, I guess we'll land now. It's nice to have people there, a warm car ready for you, rather than sitting out in the middle of a field for hours while they try to find you.
Well, that was going to be my next question, is about the crew, because it's one thing you being up there, but I'm pretty sure that there was an anxious crew listening to you telling them all about your flame outs and things on the ground. Tell me a bit about your crew. I'm assuming your husband Adam was part of that team.
Yeah, so my husband was the official photographer, and then I also had my father on my crew along with my official observer, Tim Cloyd, and then we had some local pilots who came and helped us as well. And a funny story though, everything about these, it's such a small balloon, weight is so critical. So, I mean, not only did I, try to carry as little as possible, I was measuring things like how much did my base layer weigh? How much did my radio weigh? How much, I lost over 20% of my body weight. And I sat there in my kitchen about a week before this flight and was weighing my different aircraft radios to see which one was ounces lighter. So in an effort to conserve all this weight, because I thought I was going to be pushing it on fuel. And so I brought one radio, and there was a fairly large airport there that gets some jets in and out of it that I launched by. And then behind me, not too far, there was also an Air Force base. And so I wanted to make sure that I could talk to all of the air traffic controllers and the airplanes as needed, and they're coming in and out. So I only took an aircraft radio with me. And the idea was I would take the aircraft radio, I would talk to the air traffic controllers, and then when they released me from their zone, then I would just switch over to a common frequency and my crew could dial into that, and then I would talk to them. Well, that all worked really great until I tried to switch it. And remember, I mean, you're just strapped into a chair. I don't have pockets for anything. I'm holding onto this radio that I try to keep stored kind of in my breast pocket to keep a battery warm so it doesn't die on me. And I pull it out to switch the frequency. And with my gloves on, I accidentally hit the emergency frequency and for the life of me could not get it off of this frequency. Just like, well, I can't transmit over the emergency frequency. So I spent, you know, 30 seconds trying to figure that out before I was, you know, dropping like a rock again and trying to get that situated, and then decided, you know what, screw it. They have a tracker on me. They know where I'm at. You know, they'll be able to find me eventually. You know, I had a cell phone on me that when I landed, they could call me. They could see me the whole flight, so it wasn't a big issue. But, you know, they were freaking out on the ground, especially when I'm at the hour and a half mark and I had told them I'd be up and down in an hour, and they're still seeing me up in this, you know, trying to figure out what's going on and why isn't she coming down? What's happened? Yeah. So there's a little bit of,
it's always a good way to test that people actually care for you by putting them under that sort of pressure.
Yeah.
Hi, we hope you're enjoying this episode. Just a quick reminder that you can support Auntie Monkey by going to patreon.com/AuntieMonkey or going to the donate page on AuntieMonkey.com, where you can pledge as little as $1 per episode that will help us get all the software, the hosting, and the equipment that we need to produce better quality podcasts for you. Anyway, enough from us, back to the episode. So you obviously got the bug for it, because 3 months later you then decided to go and do another one. So this was a slightly bigger balloon from what I understand, and then flew a lot further the second time as well.
Yeah, so I affectionately call this my big balloon, even though it's still less than half the size of, you know, a normal sport balloon. But yeah, so I mean, this is the record that I had been wanting to break for 2 years. And so, or maybe even longer. But yeah, so this one was, we configured this with the kind of the collapsible bottom end that I mentioned. This was pretty much a standard Lindstrand 42 setup with the collapsible. It was a Lindstrand collapsible bottom end. It had carbon fiber poles holding it up. And I actually fit five titanium tanks in there. So I had about 1 foot by 2 feet square space to kind of spin around in place, but not much other room to, couldn't do anything else other than that.
And so this was purely a distance record that you were trying to break rather than an altitude?
Yep, this one was just distance.
And what did you end up getting for that flight?
So I have to look it up in kilometers. Sorry, that's a switch between miles and kilometers. So I went 587 kilometers.
And what was the record prior to that?
The previous overall record was 434.7 kilometers. And the female one was 288.29 kilometers.
So with that flight, obviously, yeah, you're not dangling your feet over the side. But what was the plan? Was it to do again, go to a decent altitude, or is it really just find the fastest lower winds and just go for it?
Yeah, I mean, you try to find, you know, the lower the better, the more fuel efficient it is, but you really have to get up into the jet stream or you're not going to make it. So I ended up, my cruising altitude was 15 to 16,000 feet for this whole flight, and it was about I was just 10 minutes shy of 6 hours in the air.
And again, were you doing this in sort of freezing cold conditions? I mean, obviously it's in March, so it's probably not going to be that cold, or was it still?
Yeah. So it was slightly warmer. I took off in warmer warmer temperatures. I think it was just barely above freezing where I took off. And I landed, and it was actually almost, it was almost 40 degrees Fahrenheit. So it had gained about 15 degrees maybe, but I had also traveled many hours south as well. But at altitude, it's colder the higher you go up. And so at altitude, it was still about negative 30 Fahrenheit. So it was still pretty cold.
For that flight, where did you fly from and where did you end up?
I flew from Mitchell, South Dakota, and I flew across the entire state of Iowa and landed in the southeast corner of Iowa.
And with a flight like that, it's obviously, it's a long way. There's ends up being a fair bit of logistics because I'm pretty sure you would have flown through a lot of airspace and mm-hmm. those sorts of things.
Yeah. So it's kind of same thing. I did take another radio on this flight. Bigger balloon allowed me an extra radio. But yeah, my whole thing is safety. I want to make sure that, it's not just me looking out for me up there. Especially I'm also a fixed wing pilot, so I can fly single engine planes. And after getting into that world, I kind of realized how much there's a lack of, how little airplane pilots are looking out the windows when they're on autopilot. And it's a bit scary when you're flying a balloon up there. And you realize,
especially a transparent one.
Yeah,
too.
These guys aren't looking out at all, and you're just a blip. They're not going to pay attention to you. So I was in constant contact with the air traffic controllers, and I had what we call flight following. Mm-hmm. So you call up an air traffic controller, and they can see you on their radar. And they can follow your flight path. With the balloon, though, I wasn't carrying a transponder or anything for them to see how high I was. So I would have to tell them how high I was. But then when there was somebody who was flying close to me, they could tell them to look out for their traffic and where I'd be at. Kind of nice to have somebody else out there looking out for you and making sure they're telling other people to watch out.
Right. And during that flight, did you have any excitement like the flame outs and those sorts of things? Obviously at 15,000 feet, again, your oxygen's getting low.
Yeah. So we learned a lot from the failed attempt. In that one, after every one of these flights, it was all new O-rings, new stuff. We also put some hand warmers on my burner block to kind of keep those O-rings just nice and pliable so they wouldn't freeze and cause flame outs or God forbid a leak or anything like that. So this flight was a lot better. There really wasn't as many, just a handful of times that there were, which was more comforting. But it's a busy flight still talking to people. It's not, it's not 6 hours up there twiddling your thumbs. Kind of as we all know, it's the short frequent burns are your most fuel efficient, and that's the name of the game in record flights, is how efficient can you be, how essentially like a robot you can be spot on. And so it was a lot of, at that altitude, you have no, there's no visual reference. So you can't tell if you're shooting up like a rocket or falling, or, if you're straight, it's so hard to tell what you're doing. So it's a lot of staring at your flight instruments and trusting them. And as soon as, it's almost off the peg, you give it some more to make sure you're not going to start dropping before you know it, or vice versa, and making those burns as short as possible, because it is really cold and you're up at altitude. So a little goes a long way, and you could be going up 500 feet, before you know it.
It must have been a fairly good lats workout holding your arm above your head for 6 hours.
That was the first thing I commented to my husband when I got down. I said, I really need a massage. My shoulders are killing me.
Nice. So in terms of your record flights, then you've also done some long jumps and things like that. Have you got that passion now that you want to start going further or higher or far longer?
Yeah, it's more of a pushing myself to do it kind of thing. I did a long jump. The only long jump I've done, actually, was with my husband. I made a deal with him that if I got done with these record flights, before the long jump period ends. So in the U.S. with the BFA, we have a national long jump competition that goes through the end of March. And you can just, it's kind of an on your honor system. You submit your flight track and you go for a long jump, whatever you want. I mean, even if it's 25 miles or, you know, something that's, as long as you go, just push yourself a little further than you've been before, we'll go. And so on March 31st, it was actually good weather. And so I promised him if I was done with my stuff by then, we would go do a team long jump. And so we went up and we flew 125 miles, the two of us, and it took about 2 hours to do, a little over 2 hours. But that was kind of cool. It's weird to, you know, go from, because I always said I wanted to do a long jump to kind of get my feet wet with the record stuff first and see, you know, what I could expect on one of these types of things. And it just never ended up working out. The weather was bad, or, you know, I didn't have crew, or, and then, kind of things just worked out to do the record flight. So we just went for it. And, so it was kind of cool to just go up on one of these flights, especially since I had my husband there. It was weird to have somebody else in the basket and, you know, make him do all the, trying to keep it straight and level. And I could actually look out and enjoy the view for once.
Nice. So I wanted to shift gears a little bit, because there's another part of ballooning that you're very active with, and with your husband, Adam, which is the Balloon Training Academy that you've set up. From what I understand, it's a non-for-profit academy to help people get basically into ballooning and also help get their licenses. But you've also got a big focus on safety. And I was hoping you'd tell me a little bit about what you've done there and what sort of the plans with the training academy.
Yeah, so my husband and I just have a big passion for getting people into the sport. When we both started, we could literally count on one hand the number of pilots getting in. Well, we want to make sure that, you know, when we're older, that there are still balloon events to go to. There's still, you know, there's new pilots, there's people to go fly around, there's things to do, events to go to. So we want to make sure that just ballooning keeps thriving and keeps growing, and other people get the chance to enjoy things like we have. So we started out actually being camp directors. When we were just 21, we put on a balloon camp for 3 years where we'd help people from ages 12 to 18, kind of get their either more into ballooning, further towards their goal of becoming a pilot, or get their first taste of what ballooning is like. And then kind of from there, we just, we thought of other things we could do. So we started up this Balloon Training Academy, and it's a nonprofit, and it started out as just an online ground school because we realized there was just this huge need for this ground school training that people weren't getting. A lot of these pilots have gotten their license years ago, and they don't, you know, they don't remember the things we don't use all the time in ballooning. You know, so that's, they needed help getting, as a basis for their, to take their written knowledge exam. And, so it started out with that. And, now we've kind of grown to, we have, things to help flight instructors. So get a refresher for them if they have, you know, so they've been flying for 20 years and now they have a crew member who wants to get their license, and to help them remember those fundamentals of instructions and a syllabus for them to go through, kind of gives them a step-by-step on, you know, how to progress and teach a student. And that we have also added a safety seminar this year because of the coronavirus. A lot of people aren't having access to go to their annual safety seminar. So we wanted to make sure there was a way for everybody to be able to get that in each year and get their requirement in a way to do it safely without endangering others. But yeah. And so it's been really successful, and it's been really rewarding. In the 3 years we've had the training academy, we've helped 40% of all new pilots that have gotten their pilot's license in the U.S. have gone through our training academy, which is really cool. I mean, it's kind of outstanding.
It is. And how does it work? Is it a lot of the assets that you've created is self-serve, or is it actually yourself and Adam actively teaching classes and spending time with the students?
Yeah, so it's kind of a mix. Most of it is an online ground school, so it's self-paced, but there is interaction with us. So they'll turn in assignments that we'll grade, or I mean, always if people have questions, we're available. But we've also helped people put on, using our materials, put on in-person ground schools as well. And then Adam and I are always speaking at safety seminars, not necessarily related to the Balloon Training Academy, but we have a passion for, one of the things that how to keep people in ballooning longer is you got to be safe about it. So we have a passion for safety and, different facets of ballooning. And so we speak at a lot of safety seminars. And just last month, I think it was, we bought our first club balloon for the Balloon Training Academy. So we're going to be able to send that balloon around to people who don't have access to a balloon. So a lot of people in the U.S., their instructor has a balloon, or maybe their instructor flies for a ride company, so they don't own a balloon themselves. So they don't have access to a balloon. So we wanted to make sure that not only could people get their written knowledge experience, but they could also, if they were having trouble getting flight experience, we would be able to provide that. So we have a list of instructors that if people come to us and say they're not in our area and we can't teach them, then we'll recommend somebody else to them. And if they need help finding a balloon, we can do that too.
And I guess being that this is an international audience, are the assets that you've got, is it some way applicable for international, or is it it's focused on the US?
Yeah, most of it's focused on the US, because we have a different set of requirements with the FAA than, say, you guys would for your pilot's license. But we have helped people get their US license based on a foreign license. So we fielded a lot of those questions. So if anybody, wants to do that, feel free to reach out and we can help you with that process.
Yeah, you might be getting an email from me shortly. Fantastic. And then, so what's the plans with the Academy? I mean, I know I've just seen recently on Facebook, you're getting some affiliations with the FAA and some agreements there. What's the future plans with the Academy?
Yeah, I mean, our goal, our mission statement is just to bring the launch field to the students. So really it's our long-term goal is just to get as many people into ballooning as we can. So we hope to acquire more balloons and be able to kind of station them in different areas across the U.S. to make sure people have access. Because when ballooning was in its heyday in the U.S., we had a lot of club balloons where multiple people would, go in and buy one balloon. And that's fallen out of favor. And that's how most people in the 80s and 90s got their license. And you don't see that anymore. And it's caused a really big roadblock for most people to get their license. Balloons are expensive. And so we want to make sure that people have, all the tools they can to get into ballooning, because you don't want to send a kid to buy a brand new, $40,000 balloon or whatever it may be, out the get go. It's doesn't make any sense. So we want to make sure that people have access to all, anything they could need to do that. And with the safety stuff with the FAA, we just we want to be a source for, not only people to get the training, but to get sound training and to get, make sure it's quality stuff and that they know that, this is vetted by, not only, it's not just Kim and Adam's thing. It's, the FAA said, we're taking a lot of our stuff is, vetted through the FAA, then that we know that it's going to be quality material.
Well, I think it's fantastic what you're doing because, I mean, around the world, often safety seminars and things like that just do not happen because it takes people like yourselves who actually have a passion for it to want to run it. And then the second thing is actually getting people to bother showing up. But I think the way you're doing it seems to be, it's a very professional operation. So I think it's really got a lot of merit from that perspective. So yeah. It's great that you're doing that. So the final question I guess I have for you, because you've obviously already done a lot in ballooning, it's what's next for you? Like, what are your short-term, long-term plans when it comes to ballooning?
Well, in the very short term, I really wish the weather would cooperate and I could actually just go fly or, I guess, be out of quarantine. That has to happen first. Yeah. For coronavirus. Yeah. I mentioned just on the near horizon, I'd like to get my ultimate goal for the AX2 flight. I'd like to fly that 14,000 cubic foot balloon to 15,000 feet. And get the overall world record. I'm not one to settle for the female record. So I was a bit disappointed when the cloud bank came in over me. A world record is a world record, so I guess I can't complain too much.
So at this rate, I assume you need to wait till next year to do that when it gets cold again?
Yeah, so I decided to take a winter off, which I'm very glad I did. It's a big time sink doing records. I mean, I probably checked weather, 50 times a day. I'm checking all the different models and, possible outcomes and doing all my spreadsheets calculations to see if it could be feasible on any given day. And so it's a lot of effort along with having my full-time job and, trying to keep that. And so I took this winter off just as a break, and it ended up being a good winter to take off because it's not gotten cold at all this year. So it was a fortunate choice for me to, I wasn't kicking myself too much this year for missed opportunities.
And the competition side of things, is the plan to try and come to the women's worlds again?
Yeah. So I still love competing. So I'm going to try to do that. Junior nationals in the U.S. was just canceled because that was the Great Texas Balloon Race. So still going to compete as much as possible. And just keep having fun with it.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for your time today. It's been great. There's so many different topics we could have dug deeper into. But I think over the next while, we could probably end up having a second session and go into some of the topics in a little bit more detail. Or once you break that ultimate record next year, we can have another follow-up session to talk about that one.
Yeah, hopefully.
So thank you, Kim. That's been great.
Thanks, Andrew.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that episode. Remember to follow us on Facebook, as well as check out our website at auntiemonkey.com. That's where we have all of our previous episodes, as well as in each of the episodes pages, we include a lot of photos and other material. Also, please get in contact with us if you have any suggestions of people you'd like us to talk to, or if you've got some stories of your own that you'd like to share. So anyway, until next time, thanks for supporting Auntie Monkey.